I'm excited today because we have Greg Baumer here, who is a co-author of this book right here, which is called True Riches, What Jesus Really Said About Money in Your Heart, as well as another book called God and Money, which we happen to have a book called God and Money. There's only so many titles in the Christian financial space. But anyway, I'm really excited to chat. I've been reading through this book, and there's just so much goodness in here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that are just getting me to think and just evaluate. And if we're all honest, like, none of us have this stuff figured out of how to perfectly balance our hearts and our finances. And I just really like a lot of things that Greg has said and his approach to all this. Yeah. And so anyway, all that to say, Greg, thank you for taking some time to come chat with us today.
Guys, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited because I started digging in, and really how we want to approach this conversation is just pull out some, certain things you guys are talking about in the book, and I know that John wrote a good part of it, and I can't tell who exactly wrote everything, so you can tell me if we get to a point where you're like, well, I don't know, well, John comment on that, but...
All the parts you don't like, John wrote those parts.
Sure, that's it. That's the answer, right? But there's just some really powerful statements in here and mm-hmm. little passages I'd love to just read and just comment on and just kind of go from there. But Greg, let's start with this. Tell us how you came about to write this book. What I know of you is that you and John were at Harvard among all of the wealth, pomp, everything else, and God did something in your heart. So can you take us back to that point and can we start there?
Yeah, you got it. So John, my co-author and a very close friend, he and I both grew up in good Christian homes, came to faith as children, were interested in business from a young age. And for some reason, for both of us, these two parts of our lives, our faith and our interest in business and money, we never thought deeply about the intersection between those two things as we were growing up and in our early career. And so despite loving Jesus, we also both developed really unhealthy views toward money. And I think mm-hmm. it was, in fact, those unhealthy views that led both of us to enroll at Harvard Business School, which is where we met.
Yeah,
and we found ourselves, you know, here are two Christians in this school that they call the West Point of capitalism. And it sort of forced us to examine this question of how should my faith inform how I think about money?
Yeah.
And we took a class over at Harvard Divinity School called God and Money that explored the intersection of faith and finance in our culture. In our final term paper for that course, we wrote about how we would try to be wise stewards if we were ever blessed with more financial resources than our family needed. And God used that paper to completely transform our understanding of his call on our lives with respect to money, but ended up penetrating so much deeper into our hearts because at least for John and me, it was our views of money that were, I would say, off base, that were prohibiting us from living more wholeheartedly in Jesus more broadly. That term paper ended up becoming the first book you mentioned, the one that we share the title of, God and Money. And that was a fantastic project, but it was also a really long and nerdy book that came out of this term paper. And we wanted to then, you know, have a resource that was more broadly applicable and frankly easier to digest. And so that's where the True Riches book came from.
Yeah. That's great.
That's great.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think this book is very easy to digest. And I have the other one, and I don't... It's on my shelf somewhere on my, like, to-do list to read. And anyway, just haven't gotten to it yet. But this book, I have read through most of it and really enjoying it. But I want to take you back to this quote here, okay? So it says, "Unfortunately, despite my Christian upbringing, I was never taught about financial issues in church. Real, honest dialogue about faith and finances is rare. For some reason, the two seem to be allergic to each other. We typically don't talk about money with our spiritual mentors, or we think about faith when we're paying off a student loan or buying a house. On the rare day that we learn about money in church, we usually hear a formulaic life plan that looks something like this. Get out of debt, achieve home ownership, save for retirement, live a comfortable, secure life. Just be sure to give 10% of your income away. Follow this path faithfully, and you'll become stable and secure and maybe even rich. And this formula basically teaches us to do exactly what the culture around us does. with a special emphasis on staying debt-free and giving 10% away. It puts a nice Christian halo over the American dream. And it said, but when my friend Greg and I guess this is John writing, started looking more closely at the teachings of Jesus, we could not find a single reference to anything like this formula, despite how frequently he taught about money. We had a hunch something was missing. So, the Christian halo on the American dream. Like, yeah. Tell me more. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much underneath that statement. I think two main points I'd love to call out. One is, I think that passage that you highlighted illuminates the degree to which our culture is steeped in materialism. Mm-hmm. So much so that we don't even notice it. I firmly believe that when our generation is in heaven, I think God will say, look, y'all did some great things. 1 billion people uplifted out of abject poverty, massive reductions in slavery and sex trafficking, you know, many other positive kingdom movements. And I think he'll also say, y'all, especially in the West, y'all committed the sin of materialism every minute of every hour of every day of your entire life, so much so that you didn't even notice it. We're so deep in it, we can't even see it. Yeah. Which then leads to my second point, which is the lack of vision or the low bar that our church leaders have toward how the church broadly, capital C, should be thinking about money and resources. We give so little, and we spend so much of our resources on materialistic pursuits that our pastors would be happy if we lived the way as you described in that passage. You know, most Christians give about 2% of their income. Pastors would be thrilled. They wouldn't know what to do with their budgets if everyone in the church was giving 10%.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Not that there's magic to 10%, but rather it's an area that the church, that our church leaders don't push us toward handing over to Jesus. You know, I find that men, for instance, are more open to admit pornography addictions than they are financial decision making to in their community groups.
Wow.
How odd is that? And so I think it just speaks really to where we're at in our cultural moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting, like, because I think about this a lot. Like, I mean, one of the things we talk about with our people all the time is you're not going to get to heaven and regret that you gave big. Like, none of us are going to get there and be like, man, I wish I wouldn't have given so much. Like, you know, it's the same thing. Like, you know, and I think it's just painful. I don't know, to even acknowledge that. Cause I mean, I feel like we've come a long way in our walk and our generosity, but like, there's so much more room to grow. And like you're saying, like, we're just so steeped in it that even when we're actually doing decent, relatively speaking, in this journey of being generous people, like, we're still like nothing compared to what I think probably the ideal is of, you know, what God was envisioning for us, you know? And anyway, yeah.
Well, and I think we're so entrenched in what everyone else has that it's hard not to think that way. Right? Because it's like it's in your face all of the time. As soon as you pick up your phone, it's like you can see everything that everybody else is doing better than you.
That's right. I think.
Or more fun.
That's why Jesus talks so much about it. You know, something like 1/3 of Jesus' parables relate to money. And I think he understood that the human heart is particularly prone to the trappings of money and wealth.
Yeah.
You know, Tim Keller had this great quote, which I won't be able to repeat perfectly. But the notion is, it's not so much that money is the idol, but rather it is the oil and engine that allows us to pursue our idols. And I think that's why, you know.
Yeah.
I think another point, Linda, to the point you just made, one of my biggest trip up areas is I only compare myself upwards. I only think about people who are doing more or have more than me. I don't think about those who, you know, so that becomes my comparison set. And even as my own financial situation may elevate, I then readjust my comparison set to only be, you know, those who are now still above me.
Yeah.
And, you know, firstly, I shouldn't be that shouldn't be my measuring stick. Like comparing myself to others, yeah. irrespective of positioning, should not be my measuring stick. My measuring stick should be abiding in Jesus. But it does, I think, tell us something about human nature that we just look upwards.
Yeah. No, and I felt exactly the same way. Like that really, really resonates.
Yeah.
I want to read this other passage here. It says, spending all of our income on ourselves in pursuit of fulfillment to the detriment of our generosity is like regularly committing adultery. Such a, you know, and this is all according to Hebrews. And I want to go back and kind of
That's a bold statement that I really am excited for you to talk more about.
I want to pull this back a little bit. Okay, so further previous page, it says, coveting at its core is simply the belief that if I had more, I would be happy, which I think is really, really good. And it says, it's easy for us to agree that unrepentant, flagrant sexual sin indicates a lack of true faith or devotion to Jesus. But the Bible says the same is true for unrepentant, flagrant coveting. Okay, and this goes back to this passage in Hebrews that you right above, where it says, let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And one other section in this real quick I want to read, and then we can talk about it. But our culture teaches us to be generous with sex and to closely guard our money. But God teaches us to be generous with our money and closely guard our sexual purity. And there's so many powerful things here. And it said, I got to read this too, okay? Sorry, I'm just reading all your book here, but it's just so good.
This is the podcast. You just read the entire book.
Whole thing. It says, if you're reading this in a climate-controlled room and you know where your next meal is coming from, you're going to have you're among the huge number of people who have been given amazing prosperity here in the 21st century. We tend to take for granted our access to food and drink, soft bed, plenty of clothing. Yet in the midst of this abundance, we've been seduced by the pursuit of a nicer lifestyle, find ourselves struggling to give 10% of our income away. The church collectively prayed, give us this day our daily bread. And God answered the prayer, generously entrusting us with enough funds to buy mountains instead of bread. Instead of sharing it where he intended, however, we ate our fill, and then we used what was left over to buy nicer homes, nicer cars, vacations, private schools, until there was nothing left to share. Anyway, all of that, so good, so good.
Yeah.
Thoughts? Tell me more.
Yeah, thanks. So I think the word that comes to mind as the common thread through those passages you just read is misplacement. And what I mean by that is all of those examples in the passages you read are examples of how we misplace hope, we misplace affection, we misplace what will bring us happiness. You know, I think the statement that the misuse of money is analogous to adultery is because it is pursuing, both of them are examples of pursuing happiness in the wrong places by taking control of things that are not ours.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, good. That's why that analogy holds. I also think using our money to pursue this, you know, quote unquote American dream assumes that that security and lifestyle will bring us joy and purpose. Which if you really ask people, they know it's not true. They know it's not true.
We all know, but we want to find out for ourselves.
But we do it anyway, right? And when I'm saying we operatively here, like, I still do this all the time. You know, we all live in Middle Tennessee, Nashville area, which is this like weird cultural milieu of like high Christianity and like high flash, you know, like becoming a, one of my worst sins is I try to be like 10% more Christian than my neighbors. I do this like all the time. And I know I do it, and I try to not do it, but I still do it. So it's like, you know, I'm not going to buy that car. I'm going to judge them for having that car and get like one click less nice of a car. Not real. And I tell myself it's because I'm stewarding wisely, but really it's because like I want to, in my own heart, feel like I'm being holier than thou.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think... I do that all the time. And I think that's actually like pretty common.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that if you are kind of like, here's the thing. I think anything that God will give us to use as a blessing in our lives, the enemy will try to make it not that. And yeah. So even the idea of, well, I want to steward my money well, like there's that desire in your heart because we're trying to please God. And the enemy comes in and is like, yeah, you're such a good Christian. Look how much better you are. And I think that that happens all the time. And I mean, Bob and I have talked about this too, is, you know, we've had giving on our heart for a long time. Like, we feel like this is a mandate from God in our lives, but we have also noticed that in us pursuing that as best as we possibly can, that there's been that creep in of, oh man, you guys are so good about this. Like, you're so generous. Look how awesome you are, you know, and the idea
pride
of judging
anywhere, yeah.
other people based off of what we're like, how we're living because we felt like God called us to do it. It's just, it's mind-boggling to me that that can happen, that the pursuit of Jesus can become the idol.
Yeah.
Yes. I totally relate to, I do that a lot. It's a good example of how hard it is to keep the focus on him and not mm-hmm. on yeah. ourselves.
Yeah.
And I also think, like, we also want to make sure not to overcorrect and get into guilt zone where yeah. we're giving out of guilt at what we have or guilt that we haven't been more generous. That's also missing the mark. Mm-hmm. It's more yeah. like, it's really asking the question, why does God call us to give? And mm-hmm. honestly, in like all the years since we wrote the first book, and John and I have had the chance to meet thousands of radically generous families, what I'm about to share would be like the most important lesson that God has taught me from all of that experience, which is, why does he call us to give in the first place? And I think it's in direct response, Linda, to what you just said, which I relate to. The more that I've prayed about this and engaged with people on why God calls us to give, first, it's not because he needs our money. So right. that's number one.
Yeah.
His work is not predicated on me being generous. He'll mm-hmm. accomplish his purposes as sovereign, you know, creator of yep. the universe. So why does he call us to give? You know, I would offer three main reasons. One is because he himself is ultimately generous, and we may better understand his character by reflecting that generosity back toward him. Yeah. You know, God so loved the world that he gave. And so mm-hmm. generosity is inherent in his character. Second is because we grow in sanctification as we emulate the character of Jesus. And because yeah. Jesus was generous, that is one of many character traits that as we copy it, we grow in sanctification. That is, we grow in Christlikeness.
Yeah.
And then third is, for some reason, God's design for the world is that we actually get to participate alongside him in bringing forth his kingdom here mm-hmm. on earth. Sometimes I do wonder why he has called us knuckleheads to be, you know, on his team in that respect, but we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think, so in summary, we give because to better understand God's character, to become more like Jesus, and to participate in his kingdom work. And what I have realized is that when our giving is motivated by those three things, that is giving as a joyful act of worship. And that's mm-hmm. the answer to why God calls us to give, as a joyful yeah. act of worship. And when I'm able to give through that mindset, I experience him more deeply. And if I'm giving with any other mindset, I don't worship him in joy and I miss the mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. And that's why I think we have so many Christians that are giving and are like, well, this isn't working. Or, you know, they give and they're frustrated because they think,
well, they're expecting something.
Yeah, they have a different expectation.
That's why it's not working.
Right. Because they're expecting it they're expecting God to bless them in the way that they decide they want to be blessed.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah. We can see how well that works as we see the ancient Hebrews fumble around in the desert trying to call upon God to bless them the way they want to be blessed, and how well that worked out for them.
Yeah. Wow.
One of the things you said in this book that I really, really love, I think this is such a strong and powerful statement. It said, in cars and in all of life, and previously you were just talking about different cars and this idea, and you were talking about how you didn't buy a high-priced car when you graduated, ended up settling with something quite a bit older, which I laughed at because in my book, we have a picture of me with a 12-year-old bubble Taurus. Remember the bubble
Amazing.
One?
Oh,
it
yes.
looked like a big bubble. Like,
great.
And so yeah. I was driving that around at, I would say, the peak of our financial success. And
well, and that was the first car you bought that that was not like a brand new car, right? I think that was
maybe.
Our first
yeah,
dip into the let's buy an old used car for the sake of, you know,
but
being
I,
better with our money. And yeah, at the peak of our financial success, he's
it.
Driving around this car that is just.
Well, and I really related when you talked about it as your granny car or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But you said something there that I thought was just really good and that honestly I wasn't doing at that point. It, for me, I almost had like some pride of, you know, back to that Christian Halo and the American Dream, a little bit of pride, maybe a lot, I don't know, of look at all those idiots buying their new cars and wasting all their money on that depreciating asset. Look at me. I bought this car. I'm going to sell for the same amount 10 years later, you know? And like in my mind, it's like this is a something that's going to put me ahead financially and they just don't even see it. Whereas what you said that I thought was so good is when you drove that old granny car, how did you say? You said something about like...
It was a reminder.
A reminder of your heart or something. Can you finish that for me?
Yeah. I don't remember the exact quote from the book, sadly. But the way I do think about...
You don't remember every single thing you said in here?
Yeah, almost, just not that line. No, I'm kidding. The way I now think about that car, and the real quick backstory, by the way, is I wanted to buy a fancy car. But as I mentioned earlier, not too fancy because I wanted to be like a smidge
yeah.
more holy. So
yeah.
I wanted like an Acura. I'm certain yeah. that an Acura is like in the center
not a Benz.
Of that
will. I'm going to get on to Acura. Step it down.
But my wife spoke wisdom to me and she was like, you don't need that car. And so I remembered that my grandma had a 02 Mercury Grand Marquis sitting in her garage that she couldn't drive anymore.
Upgrade.
That's what I drove. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I drove for like 7 or 8 years until sadly I actually got in an accident. It was totaled. Everyone was okay, thankfully, but
good.
That car for me at least served as a daily reminder that my value is not in my stuff, it's in Christ. And at least for my wiring, I needed that daily reminder.
I'm the same way. Like that's been really, really helpful.
Well, value and probably identity too, because like the
totally.
Car you drive says something about who you are, you know, or to the world it does anyway.
Yeah. In the West, that's just what we do.
Yeah. It's an extension of your personality, how much money you make, your status, your, you know, all that stuff. And it takes time or whatever. I mean, we have two pretty old cars. One of them we really like. One of them, we're both like, this car... I call the car clumsy because it's been hit so many times by just different things.
Yeah.
It's been hit a lot.
It gets in its own accidents,
it
even
really
when we're not driving
it. It really does feel like it. It's like, I don't understand how this car has been hit this many times. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like you get in the car and you're like, this is who I am. I'm the person that drives the beat up minivan that... it is that thing where it's like I am not the sum total of the car that I drive.
Yeah,
this is not who I am. This is not I think that that's great, and I think that that's such a refreshing way to look at it as a reminder of, can I still drive this and be the same person? And the answer
mm-hmm.
is yes.
Yeah.
Of course we can, but do
and
we actually think that way?
Glory of God.
Because
like, that's what it comes down to. Because we're not just driving an old car for the purpose of driving an old car. It's
mm-hmm.
for what we can do for the kingdom as a result of doing that.
Yeah.
And not spending all of our
that's
money
right.
on our car, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's a few truths embedded within that. First, I just want to say, like, it's not a sin to have a nice car. You know, like, that's fine.
We're in the same boat. We're 100% in the same boat.
You know? Right, exactly. Yes. I knew as much. And so, just to release any listeners, like, it's fine.
Yes.
Well, yeah, because some people are listening freaking out right now. And... yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I do think they're connecting all the way back to what we said at the beginning around the nature of the culture in which we live and its materialistic obsession, so much so we're not sure we're in it. I do think it's helpful for all Christians to have a few tangible expressions of speaking up and against that culture. I don't think we as Christians are called to like live in a cardboard box and like not have possessions. Like, I don't think asceticism is sound theology, but I do think it's helpful just because of the way the human brain and heart works to have a few expressions of like, I'm purposefully choosing something meaningfully below my means as a symbol of my decision not to idolize materialism.
Yeah.
Really, so good. For, you know, our two families, like we chose our car for that. Like you guys have chosen that and we chose that.
Yeah.
It can be other things too. I just think that's helpful. And then also, Linda, to your point about identity, part of my backstory is early in my career, very much defining my identity and worth in career success. And I'm very unique in that, really like the only person who does that. Just kidding. Like almost everyone does that, right? Like the, and it's been a journey for me to re-anchor my identity in Christ. Yeah. And again, like the way you keep score in career success is like what you do with the money that comes from it. Yeah. And so that is another reason why having a few symbols where I'm choosing to opt out of that is helpful just to remind me where my identity is found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I really like that.
And you had a quote in here from John Tyson where I love how he described it too. And I don't know if I have it pulled up, but
I know this one because I love this quote.
Go for it.
Yeah. He has this killer sermon on generosity, which if you go to the Generous Giving website, you can find it there. I highly recommend folks do that.
Great.
But he says that Christians ought to live with provocative lifestyle distinction.
Which
is such a beautiful phrasing. And his point is we ought to do that in all areas of our lives. And then in the sermon, he kind of says, but for the next 30 minutes, I'm going to talk about money because that's today's topic. And he describes how our lifestyle should look markedly different from our peer set of equivalent means, whether that's income level or net worth or whatever. Mm-hmm. It should look meaningfully different. Yeah. That is provocatively distinctive because we are Christians. And to me, it's always hard to measure, like, how much should I give? Well, you know, there's no algorithm. Like, sometimes people ask, how much should we give? And I'll say, like, I just use the formula that's in 2 Thessalonians. It's like, there's no formula. You know, if God wanted there to be a formula, there would be a formula. But I do think this notion of, like, provocatively distinctive is, like, a good benchmark. Like, do we look like we are members of the kingdom of God and not the realm of the world? If you can't tell that based on how we're spending money, I think that's like an interesting question to explore.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned that thing about asking that question, how much do I need to give? And you mentioned that here. And you said the better question to ask is how much do I need to keep? Mm. And I think that's such a powerful reframe because like you, I'm sure you've had these conversations, but like the debate about tithing and, you know, and pre and post, I'm sorry, net or gross income, and like just this whole thing. And like that's where I don't even like talking about it that much because I'm like, this isn't New Testament generosity. Like, we're talking about something different. If we look at 2 Corinthians 9, like, it's a different conversation. It's not just about how much we give, but that question we should be asking is, how much should I keep? And it's such a powerful reframe. Anyway, I'll let you speak to that.
Yeah, I think that question that God placed in our hearts was kind of like a Saul to Paul scale falling off the eyes moment for John and me.
Yeah.
Because the reframe that is taking place when you switch from how much should I give to how much do I need to keep is a reframe on who owns.
Yeah.
If you ask any Christian, does God own your possession? Like, we would all sort of intellectually assent to that point. Like, no Christian would disagree with that. The problem is that none of us live that way. So it's not a theological problem. It's a praxis problem. It's that we don't put it into practice. And asking the question that way, how much do I really need to keep, forces us to put into practice my stated belief that God owns it all. And so if it's really all his, yes, we are called to provide for our family, as we see in 1 Timothy 5 and 6. But then anything above and beyond what we need to provide for our family can be poured back into his kingdom for his purposes, because it is his after all.
Yeah.
And thinking about it that way has been hugely helpful for us in our personal giving decisions.
Yeah, that's so good. All right. Well, there is so much more good stuff in this book. And so everybody run out and buy this book. It's called True Riches, What Jesus Really Said About Money in Your Heart. And you also are, I think you're chairman at Generous Giving, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you're on the board there. And why don't you tell people quickly about Generous Giving and what you guys do there?
Yeah, thanks. Generous Giving is a not-for-profit organization that's been around for 20 years that exists to spread the message of biblical generosity. Yes, so that people give more, that's great, but much more than that, so that people may experience more wholehearted life in Jesus as they submit their whole lives to him. And in our culture, often the biggest impediment to folks doing that is their money. And so Generous Giving exists to create community of people to have conversations around that topic so that people may find more joy in him. We host a huge annual conference that's really fun. And we also do 24-hour retreats called A Journey of Generosity. We do about 400 of those a year, where a group of folks can gather around to explore how God might be calling them to live more generously. So it's a great organization, and you can check it out at generousgiving.org.
Yeah, so that's great. I actually did, I think I told you this when we chatted before, but I did one of those Journey to Generosity 24-hour things, and it was really, really great. Highly recommend it. If you're on your giving journey and you want to be stimulated and encouraged to move further down this path, that'd be a great thing to do. So
that's great. Yeah, thanks.
So anyway, thank you for coming to share.
Yes.
And again, there's so much good stuff in here. Really, really thankful that you guys took the time to write it and to put it down into paper, because I think we all need this. And so I'm just really grateful and appreciative for that. So thank you. Keep up with the good work. And we'll chat again.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Do you want some more Bob and Linda in your life? How about this?
Of course.
How would you like to hang out with us for 6 weeks and your small group or church?
And if you want to do that, just go to seedtime.com/true to find out more details. Or send us a message, DM on Instagram at seedtime, and let's chat.